podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. We're once again going back 100 years to the times of the Great War, this time between November 1914 and February 1915. Starting off, we have two excerpts from The Fra, the Journal of Affirmation, printed in November 1914. We'll hear a short story called The Family Feud, followed by this episode's timely advertisement for Flowergrams.
A Family Feud. In Kentucky, several years ago, Breathitt County was the scene of a family feud between the McCoys and the Hatfields. It began with something about a line fence. Remarks were exchanged. Then shots were fired. Accidentally, old man McCoy was hurt. Then the sons took it up, and old man Hatfield died. Ambushes followed, in which McCoys perished. The family honor was at stake. Cousins enlisted. Second cousins were told they must declare themselves. Postmasters were shot. Sheriffs were waylaid. Judges intimidated. Preachers silenced. Property rights were disregarded. Murder was rife. The courts were powerless. Not until the state stepped in, disarmed everybody, and landed the ambitious participants behind prison bars was human life safe and the orderly procedure of the courts possible. An echo of the Breathitt County feud occurred in Virginia when the Allens shot up a courthouse and killed judge, prosecuting attorney, bailiff, and witnesses and put the blind goddess to sorry flight. Will the friends please bear in mind that said McCoys, Hatfields, and Allens were not low-down white trash, nor ignorant mountaineers. They represented the best families in their respective districts. They were people with property, and they possessed influence. They sent congressmen to Washington, elected judges and sheriffs, named county officials. They were not illiterate. Also, they were church members, even if not Christians. And a good deal of their shooting was in churches, or in the vicinity of churches, schools, and courthouses. Each and all represented the aristocracy in their respective districts. All considered themselves above the law. Otherwise, they would not have taken the law into their own hands and disarranged the machinery of the courts with their six shooters whenever the law threatened to interfere with their own fond desires. These feudists were not in a majority in their respective bailiwicks. They simply took command, and the majority of the people, being peace-loving, hesitated about expressing themselves, hoping that soon the clouds would clear away. The proper perspective. In degree, now that we have regained our breath, we have found the range on the European situation. That is, we have gotten the perspective. And the consensus of the best minds seems to be that it is a family feud, a feud lifted to the nth power. All of the crowned heads of Europe are related by ties of blood or marriage, just as were the chief families in Breathitt County, Kentucky. The Tsar of Russia, the Emperor of Germany, the King of England, each and all write to each other, or did, and begin each missive, "Dear cousin." They know each other's tones, looks, habits, weaknesses, and hate like villagers who have engaged in a county seat war or wrangled as to whether the new station should be at the west end of town or at the east. King George V and Emperor William are grandchildren of Queen Victoria. George is the eldest son of Victoria's eldest son. William is the eldest son of Victoria's firstborn child. Ach mein Gott! That William's grandmother was Queen Victoria, and that he is the eldest son of her eldest child, anyway, is a good talking point, as we say in law. The Tsar of Russia is not a grandson of Victoria, but he is something just as good. He is married to a daughter of Queen Victoria's third child, and the Tsar himself is a son of a sister of the wife of the late King Edward VII. Queen Victoria was more than a queen. She was a womanly woman of great common sense. Common sense that deserves to rank as wisdom. She knew history, geography, foreign affairs, diplomacy. Her superb motherly qualities made her prize peace, love, industry, economy, and the great simple homebody virtues without which civilization cannot endure. And these qualities of uprightness, sincerity, honesty, industry, and economy are the things that have made it possible for the drum taps of the British nation to circle the globe and greet the morning sun. Yet these virtues are not Britain, so much as Teuton. The Engs, the Saxons, the Jutes, the Danes, the Norse came from the Baltic. Albert, husband of Queen Victoria, was a German, and German was the language of the royal household. When the present Kaiser was a lad of 7, Queen Victoria held him on her knees, and her grandmotherly arms about him spoke to him in German, and told him that someday he might be king, and if so, he must ever use his influence for peace and industry, for these things meant happy homes, smiling farms, busy factories, helpful schools, while war meant waste, want, disease, and death. And William remembered enough of the advice, so he referred to it on a visit to England 30 years after. The spirit of the feud. By nature and training, William is a soldier, and he has ever been a warlord first, and a businessman second, and then only at intervals. No monarch has ever been so much photographed, and all these pictures reveal the fighter, belted, booted, bespurred, ready for slaughter. The man's instincts are as inflammable as celluloid. Being a politician, he has allowed industrialism to grow and evolve. But all the workers were compelled to be also soldiers. In science, music, philosophy, invention, Germany has set the world apace. In the handicrafts, she is superb. In industry and economy, she has given us an example beyond compare. For the Germany of Wagner, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Hegel, Heichel, Humboldt, Kant, Goethe, Schiele, Froebel, we have a profound regard. King William officially declares that Russia, France, England, and the people over the sea are jealous of Germany's achievements. And this, in a certain sense, is true. Success is sure to excite jealousy. But this does not mean that the jealous ones must be subjugated, suppressed, destroyed. Jealousy is always an acknowledgement of power, and as such is complementary. The Kaiser's statement that war must come because the world was jealous of Germany is Breathitt County reasoning. And straight away, William proceeds to shoot up the world instead of using his vaunted power to encourage peace, progress, and safety. The rights of neutrals. The Kaiser knew when Austria declared war on Little Serbia that Russia would protect her child. Austria could have referred her differences with Serbia to arbitration, and William, if necessary, could have compelled her to mediate at The Hague or elsewhere. But Austria demanded the right to deal with Serbia's criminals and take over Serbia's courts, a demand which no civilized nation would or could accede and preserve its identity. Germany backed Austria up to her demands. France sympathized with Russia in protecting Serbia. Straight away, William declares war on both Russia and France, and endeavors to throttle France by marching across Belgium, using Belgian cities and forts as a base of supplies. When the Kaiser marched his armed hosts into peaceful, neutral Belgium, he knew perfectly well that England would come to Belgium's rescue, as he had agreed to do if Belgium's honor was violated. It was exactly as if a hostile country should attack Canada and use the city of Portland and the state of Maine as a base of supplies. The excuse that war events make it necessary to trample Maine underfoot in order to get at Canada would not be accepted. Also, to offer to recompense for all damages would be an insult, just as much as if gentlemen bandits should ask the use of your front parlor in order to shoot up the First National Bank across the street. Of course, England protested against Germany violating Belgium's neutrality, and will protest to the limit of her power. For industrial Germany, the Germany of art, industry, science, and music, we pledge our hands and hearts and reach out our arms in friendliness, sympathy, and love. But for the spirit of the warlord, the spirit of the Middle Ages, the spirit of dictation, domination, I am responsible only to God, never. The end of the warlord. Should Germany in turn overcome France, Russia, and England, the Kaiser's troops will take Canada, for Germany needs room for expansion. Canada, fairest and finest of all Great Britain's colonial possessions. The Kaiser will have to do this in order to ensure peace, for England must be shorn of her power both on land and on sea. Canada has more square miles in America than has the United States. 4,000 miles of borderline separate us from Canada. If the Kaiser takes possession of Canada, he will transform the long border into a fighting front. However, this is not to be. The fear that civilization is now rocking in its fall is without justification. The war will progress from horror to horror, and with it, the protest, disgust, and anger of the people will deepen. More and more will the folly and foolishness of war permeate the whole world. As men suffer more, they will see more clearly. And when this war ends, it will be the end of war. We are not witnessing the success of the warlord. We are beholding his suicide.
Every woman loves flowers. Send a flowergram this Christmas. Delivered anywhere in the U.S., passage prepaid for $5. Deluxe, $10. No matter where you live or where she lives, you can convey a message that words can never tell. Charles Henry Fox, at the Sign of the Rose, Broad Below Walnut, Philadelphia. Says one Albert H., just give Charles Henry her name and address, along with your card and remittance of $5. He will fix up a fragrant bunch of loveliness and send it rejoicing on its way, passage prepaid. Only get your order in betimes so as to ensure the pick of the rare Christmas blossoms. December 15th is not a minute too soon. Fra Fox also makes a specialty of fancy flowergrams deluxe, for which it seems a shame to ask only $10. Fra Fox's mail order system is a marvel of efficiency, but in the past it has been found impossible to reach patrons at faraway points with flowergrams direct from the sign of the rose. Orders west of the Mississippi and from far distant localities will be granted solicitous, exacting, and devoted attention by correspondents in the principal cities of the United States and Canada.
Jumping ahead to mid-December 1914, we'll be hearing from Happy Days, a paper for young and old. We'll be listening to part of a tale from the story paper, a page from a story called Fighting Fred Fay, or A Yankee Boy in the Great War.
This story commenced in number 1050, Fighting Fred Fay, or A Yankee Boy in the Big War, by Ralph Morton, author of Forced to Fight with Villa, In the War, Matt and the Mexicans, etc. Chapter 16, Wrecked by a Zeppelin. Fred's jump for the second soldier was timed just a shade too late. He was a larger and in every way more powerful fellow than his companion. Fred was floored before he could strike a blow. Meanwhile, the first man got on his feet and both held him down. Then the man he had struck began pummeling the unfortunate boy for all he was worth, while the other held his arms to the ground, resting his knees on Fred's legs. "I'll fix you! I'll make you pay for that blow!" the soldier snarled, hitting him in the face again and again. "Let up on it, Jules!" cried the other at last. "We don't want to kill the boy. Go through his pockets while I hold him." It was done. To Fred's utter dismay, they got the money packet Colonel Froissart had entrusted to him. Jules tore it open, and its contents drew from them many exclamations, of course. The packet was filled with Bank of France notes. "Pierre, this is magnificent!" cried Jules. "We are rich!" "Count them," replied Pierre. "The boy is probably a thief. Where did you steal this money, boy?" Fred made no answer. He had kept silent through it all, and determined to remain so, come what would. There were also papers in the packet. He heard Jules remark that some of them were written in German. "Answer," insisted Pierre. "Where did you get this packet?" He caught Fred by the throat as he said it, and looked and acted so fierce that the boy broke silence at last. "It was given me by a French officer to deliver to the person to whom it is addressed," he gasped. "Kill him," cried Jules. "Stick a knife into his heart." Fred gave himself up for lost. Pierre, however, wouldn't have it so. Fred was tied hand and foot and dragged back into the woods. He expected the rascals would make off with the money, but they did not. Near where he lay stood his horse hitched to a tree. Pierre now produced a bottle of absinthe from which both drank. This started their tongues going. They talked very rapidly, but it was in a dialect, and Fred could understand very little of what was said. Again they drank, and still again. By this time, Fred had made the discovery that he was very loosely tied. He felt certain that in a little time he could work his hands free. The thieves now sat down under a tree and began throwing dice, the notes in the packet being the stakes. Luck seemed to run to Pierre. He persistently won. The money, which had been equally divided at first, seemed to be all drifting his way. Again and still again they drank. The powerful liquor, it is actually a drug, began to tell on them. Meanwhile, Fred, to whom they paid not the least attention, was working away at his bonds. He soon freed his hands and with his knife cut the cords about his feet, making as little movement as possible. This accomplished, he lay perfectly still, although he could have easily escaped. "I'll get that money yet," he told himself. "They'll be dead drunk in a few minutes." His chance did not come so soon, but it came. At last, Jules, growing angry over his persistent losses, became quarrelsome. Probably he accused his companion of cheating. Fred could not tell. At last he sprang to his feet and dealt Pierre a crushing blow. A fight was on in an instant, but they were now both very drunk. They knocked each other down and tumbled about over the grass. It ended in Pierre being completely knocked out, and he lay unconscious, but whether it was from the blows he had received or from the effects of the absinthe, Fred could not tell. The boy was fully on the alert, however. Jules, who seemed to have forgotten his existence, began gathering up the notes in a maudlin way. "By thunder, now I'll get him," thought Fred. Noiselessly getting on his feet, he stole up behind the fellow, who sat with his back turned, and dealt him a smashing blow on the head. Jules fell forward on his face, recovered himself, and with a fierce imprecation staggered to his feet. Fred was ready for him. He promptly felled him with a single blow. This settled it. Jules made one or two ineffectual efforts to get up, and then rolled over and went to sleep. Fred now examined Pierre, whom he found to be sleeping too. "This is just blind luck," thought the boy as he collected the notes and papers. "I have had a mighty narrow escape." He lost no time in mounting the horse, and urging the animal forward with all speed, he was soon far away from the scene of his mishap. "I won't make another stop till I get to Bazas," Fred said to himself. He was held up on the outskirts of the little city by a mounted patrol, but his pass proved effectual, and he was allowed to proceed. Once inside the city, he found no difficulty in making his way to Madame Royland's house, where he was received by Adele, who expressed the greatest surprise and interest at seeing him once more. "My mother has gone a short distance into the country," she told Fred, "but I expect her back this evening. She will be delighted to see you. We have spoken of you many times." Of course, Fred told her his errand, but Adele would not receive the money nor the papers. "Do as you were told, and place them in my mother's own hands," she said. "Indeed, then, and she came near never getting them," he replied, and went on to tell of his adventure on the road. "How exciting!" cried Adele. "Oh, how I wish I was a man! It is in times like these that one realizes how helpless a woman really is. You will wait here until Mother returns, Fred?" "I think it will be best, especially as I am to hold on to the money," Fred replied. "Then I will send a servant to put up your horse," said Adele, and she left him soon, returning to give Fred a most enjoyable hour, at the end of which Madame Royland came. If Fred had been a relative, she could not have greeted him more cordially. "The money is all right," she assured him, "and the papers are all here. You were most fortunate to escape from those rascally thieves as you did. Won't you remain here till morning? We shall be delighted to have you." Not caring to make the return journey in the dark, Fred assented and spent a most enjoyable evening. In course of conversation, Madame Royland informed him that owing to the distracted condition of the country, she and her daughter were going to America to join a brother, and that they expected to remain there until the war was over. "And now tell me something about America," she added. "I know it is a large country, and very likely you were never in the city to which we are going. It is Chicago." "Why, I was born there, and always lived there," cried Fred. "Chicago is my home." After that, there was a lot to say, of course. It was not until a late hour that Fred finally retired. Taking leave of Madame Royland and Adele the next morning, he rode back to the wireless station, accomplishing the journey without adventure. "You are just in time," said Colonel Frassard, after thanking Fred in a hearty fashion. "The dispatches for General Spencer have come, and Renau is starting first thing in the morning." This suited Fred, of course. He went to bed early in order to get a good long sleep. As has been mentioned, he shared Renault's room. Somewhere along in the small hours of the night, he was awakened by hearing Renault spring out of bed and hurriedly begin dressing. "What's the matter?" demanded Fred sleepily. "There's a big Zeppelin heading our way," replied Renault. "The guard just looked in and told me. The Germans may be intending to destroy this plant. You better get into your clothes as quickly as you can." "Do you think they know of the plant?" asked Fred, springing up. "We are sure of it. Yesterday, a German aeroplane hovered over us. Colonel Frassard has been on edge ever since." Quickly, they ran into the open to find the colonel and several others watching the lights of the aerial monster, which was still in the distance. "She is heading right for us, boys," declared the colonel. "We better all get out of here without delay." They did so, taking their places as far from the stockade as it was possible to get and still watch the airship. It made great speed and was quickly over the stockade, where it seemed to come to a standstill. "We are surely in for it," declared Colonel Frassard. He was right. Suddenly, Fred heard a whizzing sound, and there was a tremendous explosion in the air some 20 feet above the stockade. The fragments of the bomb flew in all directions, some landing very near them, but no damage was done. "Will they drop another, think?" asked Fred. "Impossible to tell," replied Renault. "They are holding their position, as you see, so it seems likely. They had but a moment to wait before another bomb was dropped. This time, the consequences were serious. The bomb landed within the stockade, exploding on the ground, and the Zeppelin went on its way. The wireless plant was demolished, so were three of the aeroplanes. The German one was apparently unharmed. All the buildings were more or less damaged. "Can't be helped," said Colonel Frassard philosophically. "I have expected nothing else since the coming of that aeroplane yesterday. Fred said nothing, but he could not help wondering if by any chance Reddig could have found means to report on the location of the plant.
It is now the day after Christmas, 1914. From the Ardmore Chronicle, we bring you two Christmas-themed pieces, followed by an opinion piece, Women as Post Office Clerks, and finally an advertisement for the Ardmore Christmas Club.
Christmas. One dayspring of cheerfulness and freedom from cankering care and selfishness and envy in a year of toil, strife, and consuming unrest. Christmas. Marvelous boon to humanity, springing legitimately from the brief and eventful life of the carpenter's son, is a fixed institution. The 20th century could not spare it if it would, wouldn't if it could. The Christmas spirit is everywhere, pervading the world for this brief, blessed day. Leveling ranks, silencing selfishness, dwarfing care, ignoring toil, forgetting creed and cult and birth and environment, it makes peace and goodwill not only possible, but inevitable. The gifts it bears are the spontaneous fruit of the omnipotent, all-pervading spirit of Christmas, a wellspring in the desert, a sunbeam on a wintry day, a single exception to a steadfast rule. The spirit of Christmas never cloys. We cannot have too much of it. Morning, noon, and night, for breakfast, dinner, and supper, the first thing on awakening and the last thing on going to sleep, every hour of every day of every week of every month of the year, we want the spirit of Christmas. For it is the spirit of ministration, of giving, of service, of doing for others. We cannot have too much of it. Morning, noon, and night, for breakfast, dinner, and supper, the first thing on awakening and the last thing on going to sleep. Every hour of every day, of every week, of every month of the year, we want the spirit of Christmas. For it is the spirit of ministration, of giving, of service, of doing for others. Not to be ministered onto, but to minister. This motto, lived out on every day of the year, would dispel the sorrows of the world, smooth out its wrinkles, abolish its poverty, soothe its pain, comfort its heartaches, heal its diseases, make it a heaven. This is what is typified by every Christmas tree and every gift it bears, by every bulging little stocking that hangs in the chimney corner, by every wreath of holly, by every greeting and merry wish.
Christmas Homecoming. One of the great features of Christmas is the home meeting. How many hundreds of thousands who have been separated throughout the year will now be gathered together once more under the old home roof. It is well that it should be so. It warms the heart to read of the trains to the north and the trains to the south, east, and west being filled with people going home for their Christmas holidays. "I am told," said Gladstone once, "that the strain of our commercial life has loosened even the bonds that unite the family, that in the struggle for existence the parents forget the child and the child forgets the parents. Well, I read the other day that some hundreds of thousands of people were leaving London to spend their Christmas holidays at home. That is a pleasing and practical refutation of much of this pessimism." It is. If the parents did not think of the children, they would not have them home. And if the boys and girls did not think of the parents, they would not go home. Blood is a great deal thicker than water, and nothing will alter it. Go home for Christmas.
Women as Post Office Clerks. There will be general approval of the work of the Women's Civil Service League of the United States in urging postmasters throughout the country to give women an opportunity for appointment from the civil service registers of eligibles. It is understood that thousands of women have passed the tests required by law, but that they have difficulty in obtaining places. It may not be possible to appoint as many women as men in these postal positions, but after they have been invited to go into the examinations and win over male competitors, they are entitled to square treatment from the appointing powers. In certain positions calling for swiftness and accuracy, women are better than men, and this is especially true with a limited number of places in the post office department. Some men are resentful at the entrance of women into public positions on the ground that it helps to reduce their compensation. It is a big problem in many ways, but woman has come into business, public and private, to stay, and that being the case, she's entitled to fair play.
Ardmore Christmas Club will distribute tickets to contributors for Beautiful Dollhouse, valued at $50, now on display at Edward J. Lyons Hardware Store, 26 West Lancaster Avenue, Ardmore, Pennsylvania. Secure tickets from Edward J. Lyons.
It is now a few days past the new year, January 9th, 1915. Again, from the Ardmore Chronicle, a few bulletins on the war, followed by an advertisement for the Tea Room.
Zigzag fighting in Alsace, say both Paris and Berlin. Germans strike at Russians. Austrians continue their retreat through the Carpathians, and Turks are over the Transcaucasian line. Loss of life is enormous on both sides of encounters. London. The French War Office announces that the Germans have been driven from Steinbach in Alsace, and that French troops hold the German defensive positions west of Sarnay, Seinheim. This is a material advance in the Alsatian operations. Steinbach has been a scene of house-to-house fighting for several days. The German War Office describes the desperate fighting in Upper Alsace and admits the loss of the defensive positions near Sarnay. It is announced that the French have taken the heights around Steinbach, but it is asserted that the battle for possession of the village continues. A writer in the London Daily Express makes a violent attack upon Viscount Haldane, the Lord High Chancellor, asserting that he is friendly to the Germans and opposed to British interests in the war. It was announced in London recently that Lord Haldane would probably resign his position. The Russian General Staff announces that the operations in central Poland continue without change, that the Germans, after a slight success at Balimov, have been beaten back, and that the rout of the Austrians in Galicia is complete. Russian troops have taken Sutshara 2/3 of a mile from the Austro-Romanian frontier. The Germans have made a number of night attacks, and the fighting is still extremely violent. Both Russian and Turkish official statements claim advantage in the fighting near Kars on the Russian side of the Caucasian frontier. Russia says that the Battle of Sari Kamish is still on, but the Turks assert that it has ended in complete victory for them.
German submarine boat sank the Formidable, Berlin. An official announcement made public through the German official press bureau says, a German submarine boat reports by wireless to the Admiralty in Berlin that it has torpedoed and sunk in the English Channel off Plymouth the British battleship Formidable. The submarine was pursued by British destroyers but escaped unharmed.
Tea Room, Lyons Building, Ardmore. Table board solicited. Dinner every evening, 6 to 7:30 p.m. Special Sunday dinners, 1 to 1:30 p.m. Orders taken for homemade bread, rolls, cake of all kinds, pies, croquettes, and salads, sandwiches for luncheon, receptions, teas, etc.
Moving to the end of January 1915, we have three more pieces from the Ardmore Chronicle. We'll start with some interesting technology news, followed by a short verse called Never Again, and our final advertisement of the edition.
Human voice sent 4,400 miles, talking over the telephone from sea to sea. President Wilson on wire. He also converses with Thomas A. Watson in California and Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone, in New York. Washington, D.C. President Wilson Monday inaugurated the first transcontinental telephone system by speaking directly to President Moore of the Panama Pacific Exposition in San Francisco. With Mr. Moore, Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, and President Vail of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company on the wire at different points, the president extended congratulations on the achievement. It appeals to the imagination to speak across the continent, said the president to Mr. Moore. It is a fine thing for the exposition that the first thing it has done is to send its voice over from sea to sea. I congratulate you on the fine prospects for a successful exposition. I am confidently hoping to take part in it after the adjournment of Congress. May I not send my greetings to the management and to all whose work has made it possible, and make it the great event it promises to be, and convey my personal congratulations to you? With Dr. Bell listening in on the line at New York, the president then spoke to Thomas A. Watson in San Francisco. Mr. Watson was Dr. Bell's electrician at the time of the invention of the telephone, and was the first person to hear a word spoken over a telephone. "I consider it an honor," said the president, "to be able to express my admiration for the inventive genius and scientific knowledge that has made this possible, and my pride that this vital cord should have been stretched across America as a new symbol of our unity and our enterprise. Will you not convey my cordial congratulations to Dr. Bell? And I want to convey to you my personal congratulations, sir." With Mr. Vail listening in on the line at Jekyll Island, the president then spoke to Dr. Bell. "May I not congratulate you very warmly on this notable consummation of your long labors and remarkable achievements?" said the president. "You are justified in feeling a great pride in what has been done. This is a memorable day, and I convey to you my warm congratulations." The president said that he could hear Mr. Moore in San Francisco very distinctly.
Never again, noise. Watchword of the Allies, declares poet who arrives in New York. New York. Alfred Noyes, English poet and peace advocate and visiting professor of English at Princeton, reached here aboard the Lusitania. "The watchword of even the most pronounced militarists among allies," said Mr. Noyes, "is never again. When the settlement finally comes, there will certainly be a grim attempt to establish some sort of collective responsibility among nations so that treaties cannot again be torn up with impunity. The whole thing reduces itself to whether we are going to have international wars in the future. A system of international police is rather a distant idea, but I don't see why the principle of international alliances cannot be worked out."
Mr. Vivian Engel, director of Pennsylvania Conservatory of Music, will accept students on Mondays and Thursday afternoons and evenings. Residence, Ardmore Avenue, Ardmore, Pennsylvania.
Finishing off this edition of Mail Call, we have a piece from the Tacoma Times from February 11, 1915, a story of the famous Christmas truce that occurred in 1914.
English Captain Tells of Enemy's Christmas Truce by H. M. Sarle, United Press Staff Correspondent. London, June 30th. England lost a near Kipling when a German shrapnel burst over the British advance lines of trenches in the vicinity of Ypres, and numbered among its victims Captain Robert Patrick Miles of the Shropshire Light Infantry, attached to the Irish Rifles. Of all the letters from the front printed in the English newspapers, none had breathed such a spirit of optimism, nor portrayed with such humor and intimate detail the life in the trenches as those of this officer. Hitherto, they had appeared anonymously. The last he wrote was a description of the amazing Christmas truce, arranged by the soldiers themselves, after the hope had failed to induce the belligerent governments officially to enter into such an agreement. It did not reach England until 2 weeks after his death. "We are having the most extraordinary Christmas Day imaginable," wrote Captain Miles. "A sort of unarranged and quite unauthorized, but perfectly understood and scrupulously observed truce exists between us and our friends in front. A regular soldiers' is peace. The thing started last night, soon after dusk, when the Germans started shouting, 'Merry Christmas, Englishmen!' Of course, our fellows shouted back, and presently, large numbers of both sides had left their trenches unarmed and met in the debatable, shot-riddled, no-man's-land between the lines." Swap cigarettes. Here, the agreement all of their own came to be made that we should not fire at each other till after midnight tonight. There was a half-moon, and the ground was covered with hoar-frost, and one could see dim shapes wandering about or standing round in groups, English and Germans, or it would have been death to have shown a whisker an hour or so before. The men were all fraternizing in the middle. We naturally did not allow them too close to our lines, and swapped cigarettes and lies in the utmost good fellowship. Not a shot was fired all night. Today I took the opportunity of getting a close view of their wire entanglements, and, upon my word, I am sorry I did. I was not half so enthusiastic about charging them as I was. There is, to start with, about 20 feet of low wire to stumble through. The details are revolting. Anyway, there are several rows of trenches, each of them swept from the flanks by machine guns, and each with a hard-looking sort of exaggerated crinoline of barbed wire in front of it. Charging that little lot under fire will be a very pleasant business. Confound the fellow that invented barbed wire. At the best, one will tear one's only pair of trousers, and, at the worst, one will get hung up in it while they shoot you in the more tender portions of your anatomy. Seize muddier trenches. The only real consolation I got out of my trip was that their trenches seemed to be muddier, if possible, than ours. I was disappointed to see such a cheery lot of fellows, as I'd hoped to see a collection of living skeletons half covered with rags, animated toast racks in uniform. The funny thing is that, while we were fraternizing here, swapping bully beef for bread, and fags for most execrable cigars, perhaps the gift of a box of these is a symptom of hate, one can hear the dull booming of guns and a certain amount of rifle fire going on in the same old sweet way on our right and left. We neither of us know if our respective artillery behind will respect our little arrangement and abstain from taking advantage of what must be a very tempting mark, but hope for the best, as we are all mixed up in the middle. We had heard some awfully interesting latest news, made in Germany, as given out to our friends in front, in which they implicitly believe. The main items are, 1. The Germans have taken Moscow. 2. Russian casualties in the retreat, 3.5 million. 3. General Joffre is dead. 4. British fleet is practically destroyed. 5. The Allies have sued for peace, the terms of which have been agreed to and will be published in a fortnight. Can't scare them. Saturday. The peace, which was supposed to terminate at midnight, still continues willy-nilly. The beggars simply disregard all our warnings to get down from off their parapet, so things are at a deadlock. We can't shoot them in cold blood. And if we fire a shot over a man's head as a warning, he simply turns round, waves his hand to us, and goes on with whatever he is doing. I cannot imagine a more extraordinary state of affairs. I cannot see how we are to get them to return to business. Our guns, from far away in the background, rather unsportingly landed 3 high-explosive shells slap in their trench about 10 o'clock. That sent them down for 10 minutes or so, and then I'm dashed if a couple of them didn't come over and complain about it. Didn't seem to think it was playing the game at all. I rather fancy the powers that be are not best pleased with this state of affairs, but I do not see how we can help it. We are to be relieved this evening for our usual 3-day rest. The very day they returned to the trenches, Captain Miles met his death.
That concludes this installment of Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. This episode features the voice talents of Alexander Williams, Charles Griefenstein, David Ospel, Damian Katz, Laura Bang, Marie Simmons, Ramon McBride, Sarah Wingo, Susan Riley Stevens, and myself, Chris Hallberg. Historical documents were accessed through the digital collections of the Digital Library at Villanova University and the Library of Congress. Our theme music is from Till We Meet Again, that's performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War Centennial Exposition. For more information, please visit wwionline.org. Oh, and if you don't go home for Christmas, consider traveling to
Canada, fairest and finest of all Great Britain's colonial possessions.